This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Summer, part bliss, part torture for movie fans. Maybe you're the type that just needs popcorn, the air conditioning at full blast, and a few dazzling special effects strung together on a budget that resembles the annual budget of a small country. Or maybe you hide out in a less aggressively cooled art house in search of wisdom on global warming and eschewing The Man of Steel. Either way, movie makers hope to find us on the edge of our $10 seats as the fate of the planet is settled on the screen and the fate of the studios out in the box office. So far, so good, at least on the box office front. As expected, Superman shot into first place this weekend, but there are a couple of surprises this summer as well. Meryl Streep's steely turn as the boss from hell surpassed predictions for The Devil Wears Prada, and perhaps there is such a thing as bad publicity as Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible 3 struggled to perform up to expectations. This hour, the critics round up your choices at the multiplex from chick flicks, comic book heroes, and the obligatory summer Sandler Fest. Later in the hour, Israel rejects an ultimatum by Palestinian militants to trade prisoners for a kidnapped soldier. We'll bring you an update from Jerusalem. But first, what movies are you lining up for this summer? What movies kept you in your seat even after you spilled your popcorn? Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us today are three distinguished movie buffs. First is Peter Bart, the editor-in-chief of Variety, author of Boffo, How I Learned to Love the Blockbuster and Fear the Bomb. He's with us from his house in Palm Springs, California. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
With us from Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Inquirer is movie critic Carrie Rickey. She's joining us from member station WHYY. Nice to have you back as well.
Thank you, Neil.
And A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times, joins us from our bureau in New York. Good to speak with you again, Tony.
Nice to be here.
Peter Bart, summer is the season of the blockbuster. Which this summer, using this summer as evidence, which made the blockbuster category and which made the bomb?
Well, of course, the biggest blockbusters are still to come, and that is the Pirates of the Caribbean Part 2 and later Part 3. But, you know, basically you're talking about pictures that are so surreal in terms of their numbers that they're not so much sold as they're injected into every artery of the pop culture. So they don't so much reflect what people want to see. They basically reflect what the studios want to sell.
So you're talking not about necessarily good movies, but about good marketing plans.
Well, exactly. I mean, a couple of generations ago, when pictures like Midnight Cowboy or Easy Rider became hits, unexpected hits, they did so because they reflected a real change in society.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Pirates of the Caribbean doesn't reflect anything. Both Pirates and Superman are sort of oddly anachronistic pictures in a way. I mean, the minute you see Superman's little spandex outfit, you say, my God, that looks like it was designed in 1936, which of course it was. But these pictures are big hits because they're mandated as such.
You see the outfits in Pirates of the Caribbean, you figure those were made last month somewhere in London.
Well, that's a very, Pirates is a very odd picture. You know, it's not the first or third Pirates. It's a middle picture, which is designed simply to keep the characters afloat and don't kill anybody important off. But those pictures, like the second Matrix, are very, very hard to devise and not much fun to see.
And really hard to figure out. Carrie Rickey, is there something that has come out quintessentially summer movie to you this year?
Oh, boy, quintessential. Can I talk about what I like?
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I really like The Devil Wears Prada, particularly Meryl Streep, who is so glacial. She's like the corrective to global warming that the Inconvenient Truth is telling us about.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was a terrific performance and a surprising performance because I didn't much like the novel. But she gave a different reading to the movie and to this. You don't see mentee movies with women a lot. And this one was an apprentice movie, and she was really good. And you saw the human side of her and the professional side of her, really powerful and fun. I haven't had a lot of fun in the movies this summer. I liked An Inconvenient Truth. I will say, Neil, that the only two Oscar-nominatable performances I've seen this summer are Streep's and yours in Wordplay.
You know how to get on the program again and again, don't you? Tony Scott, we'll leave documentaries about crossword puzzles out of this conversation.
Yeah, it'd be a conflict of interest for me.
Indeed it would.
But I also quite like Devil Wears Prada, and certainly of the big movies that opened last week, going into the 4th of July weekend, I don't know if it makes me a traitor to my gender, but I certainly prefer Devil Wears Prada to Superman, which was, I thought, very very ponderous and took itself seriously in a way that I think an odd number of these very very expensive pop culture blockbusters tend to do. I would mention, while we're on the subject of Meryl Streep, and since I'm sitting in the NPR studio, there's another very good performance of hers that's out in theaters now, which is A Prairie Home Companion. And the two pictures together really show the kind of range that she has, and how she's still, you know, one of the most unpredictable and exciting and interesting actresses we have around.
Well, let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Linda. Linda calling us from Roseville in California.
Hi, Neil. Well, you just talked about Prairie Home Companion was my vote, and I just saw it over the weekend, and my daughters and myself were the only ones in the theater at the 10 o'clock performance. And so we hooted and hollered and had a grand old time, but they almost didn't show it because there was nobody in the theater. And so more people have to go. Streep is great. Tomlinson, Lily Tomlin, and Kevin Kline is crazy. And the two cowboys, John C. Reilly and what's his face?
Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson. We're just great. And it was kind of neat to see Gavin Keeler, that great radio face, on the big screen, too.
All right. We'll have enough about faces for radio on this program. All right. Thank you, Linda.
Okay.
All right. Peter Bart, I wonder, did you see Prairie Home Companion? What did you make of it?
I didn't see it, I regret to say. I was too busy tent poles. So I know Robert Altman's been around a long time. I know his movie will be around a while, too. I'm afraid I'm not the perfect quadrant for that. You know, movie studios always talk about... I'm afraid that was not my quadrant.
All right. All right, let's get Joe on the line. Joe's calling us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Hi. I'm actually looking forward to Snakes on a Plane. It seems a lot of my friends...
Haven't they stopped serving that sort of thing these days? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'll say that again?
I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Oh, it seems that a lot of my friends, which are, you know, in the 18 to 25 category, are really excited about it. But when I talk to parents, they're just kind of like, snakes on what? What is this about? And we just are like, it's Snakes on a Plane. That's it.
Carrie Rickey, you heard anything about Snakes on a Plane?
It sounds like a good movie for truth and titling. But I just hear that a lot of excitement on the internet. I agree with the caller. People I know in my family under 25 are very excited because they think it'll be cool. And... I don't get it, but I guess after United 93, someone wants to have fun on a plane.
I think it may also, I mean, it's a fascinating marketing campaign, or depending on how you look at it, sort of spontaneous generation of awareness on the internet, because it's been now almost a year that since the various websites and blogs started picking up on this, just based on the title and the fact that Samuel Jackson was in it.
And so this sort of viral marketing campaign, obviously Hollywood is viral marketing campaigns are nothing new for Hollywood. No,
but it's a return to Blair Witch, you know, that's really reminiscent of it, and nothing has worked in this genre since Blair Witch.
And certainly not Blair Witch 2.
And the poor guys who made Blair Witch haven't been able to make a movie. I think they just got one going now.
May I ask a question? Does anyone understand why we're having these very grim superhero movies recently? X-Men, Superman, the superheroes used to be these pop figures, and now they're kind of gloomy gothic figures. And I don't know whether it's reflecting the times or it's reflecting... Hollywood's mood.
Or does Tony Scott, does it reflect the audience?
I'm not sure that it reflects. That's a very good question, because it's been going on for a while now. There was The Incredible Hulk a few years ago. There was Batman Begins, which was very dark and gothic and tormented. The Spider-Man movies, which I think have been the most, you know, the best and the most successful, have a lot of that sort of angst mixed in with the pop culture fun. I sometimes think it's because, you know, the studios are spending so much money on these that they have to persuade themselves that these are somehow serious movies. It's very hard to say, okay, we're going to spend, you know, $150 million on a piece of junk. So a way that we prove to ourselves, perhaps, that it's not a piece of junk is to give it all of these sort of allegorical overlays. So, you know, are these movies post 9/11 movies? Are they movies about, you know, Christian allegory? I mean, they're all of these kind of very heavy interpretations that these movies seem to be dragging in their wake.
Well, certainly Superman was a Christian allegory, and I was quite surprised.
The father and the son, yeah. It was interesting to see the resurrection of Marlon Brando. That was the one thing.
Well, I enjoyed that.
Fun.
And Eva Marie Saint and Marlon Brando in the same movie, since On the Waterfront.
If we're going to vote on one resurrection, would it have been Marlon Brando? I'm not so sure. But of course, as pointed out earlier, another big movie opens up this weekend, one that is, of course, filled with angst and self-doubt. It is, of course, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Captain Sparrow.
Come to join me, crew, lad. Welcome aboard.
I'm here to find the man I love.
I'm deeply flattered, son, but my first and only love is the sea.
Meaning William Turner, Captain Sparrow.
Elizabeth, hide the rum. You know, these clothes do not flatter you at all. It should be a dress or nothing. I happen to have no dress in my cabin.
Jack. I know Will came to find you. Where is he?
Darling, I am truly unhappy to have to tell you this, but through an unfortunate and entirely unforeseeable series of circumstances that have nothing whatsoever to do with me, poor Will has been press-ganged into Davy Jones's crew.
I believe him, absolutely. I don't know about you. But anyway, we'll have more talk about summer movies after we get back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Another summer blockbuster season is underway with plenty of laughs, tears, big explosions. Oh, they bloated up real good. We'll find out what's worth watching and where to save your $10. Our guests are Peter Bart, editor-in-chief at Variety, Carrie Rickey, film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times. Of course, we want to hear from you. What's worth seeing on the big screen this season? What did you like? What did you hate? And why? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Lonnie. Lonnie with us from Athens, Ohio.
Yes. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, I wanted to talk about, actually, with the large spectacle and special effects nowadays, we're really used to that now, and I was kind of wondering if there's a slow trend anybody's noticed in, you know, getting back to, like, you know, quality storytelling amongst all this as well, and just getting back to using the effects as a tool and not so much a star, maybe.
Carrie, Rickey, what do you think?
Well, interestingly, Mission Impossible tried to do that this year with Mission Impossible 3, mm-hmm. Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Cruise were actually acting and not running in a lot of the most dramatic scenes, and I really enjoyed it. And of all the blockbusters so far this summer, that was the one I enjoyed the most, and that was the one the audiences seemed to be enjoying the least.
Wait a minute. I think Poseidon sank faster than that.
Okay.
All right.
Is it corrected?
Okay. I wonder if you had a take on this, Tony Scott?
I always hope so, and you know, every year you can decide. I mean, I think a year ago, I think it was The Bourne Supremacy was a kind mm-hmm. of traditionally cinematic kind of. It was an action adventure movie, but it wasn't heavy on the special effects and the CGI.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes think that the philosophy in the studios is just to stuff these pictures full of more and more and more of everything. And to have bigger casts, more stars, and also more CGI, and just hope that it all works. But I don't, based on this year's blockbuster so far, I'm afraid I don't discern a trend in the big budget studio movies toward character, storytelling, emotion, all of that sort of old-fashioned stuff.
It's such a shame because there used to be such great spectacles. Like, just think back to, like, Cecil B. DeMille. I mean, great acting, great story, and it was the spectacle. And, I mean, I'm more than willing. Like, there's no good storytellers out there that can't introduce great effect on top of, like, fantastic story anymore like that.
Well, I think you make a very good point because it's always gone together. It's not as if the effects are bad, and there are some, you know, great movies and filmmakers more recently than Cecil B. DeMille. Certainly, you know, Steven Spielberg, who has
put together
extraordinary stories using all of the visual resources at his command.
Or The Sixth Sense, which actually did not use special effects but was very, very involving.
Lonnie,
thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
I wonder, Peter, Bart, we've been talking about those big blockbusters that, as you were saying, are injected into our bodies somehow. What about smaller movies, independent movies? What are you looking forward to this summer?
Well, I think you have to wait for September and October to see the smaller movies, because that's when they'll all of a sudden be rebirthed. I think summer is the time for the teenagers.
Well, summer is dedicated to profit and fall to honor, I think, correct?
I think you guys are forgetting one anomaly of the summer, though, relevant to the last question, and that is The Da Vinci Code, which did $500 million outside of the U.S. and played big in Asia. It really wasn't an effects picture. None of the critics really particularly loved it for reasons I can understand, but it still represents a unique throwback to a kind of studio-era picture-making.
I think so. Yeah, I agree. And also, it's interesting because it was conceived. It's done very well overseas, and it is a kind of global blockbuster. Right? It was cast with movie stars, you know, from France and England as well as the United States, and it did better, I think, in Europe and Asia than it did in the United States. Maybe the you know, reading the subtitles improved the dialogue. I don't know.
Let's call Lisa. Lisa calling from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
Great topic. My husband and I are film addicts. We see about 70 movies a year, and so I've got my film journal in front of us. We write everything down, and we try to make our little comments and do our grades. And I was going to say, one of the movies that we just saw recently that was outstanding was District B-13, and it's a fantastic French action film. It's kind of Jackie Chan meets Bruce Lee. Just incredibly well done, futuristic, takes place in Paris in the year 2010. But the other comment I wanted to make was also about a lot of the smaller films. And I don't know, lately we've seen, you know, between Wordplay, I think An Inconvenient Truth, Down in the Valley, Kinky Boots, The Lost City, From Subway with Love. There are just some great independent films that have been out during this summer so far. Yeah, so, you know, I just sometimes, I mean, we do go to the blockbusters, but we always seem to gravitate back towards these remarkable independent filmmakers that, you know, just put such thought into what they're trying to say. And, you know, you leave with feeling that you've gotten something meaningful. And so I don't know. That's just, you know, my thought. And I don't know how you feel about that.
Here.
Can I ask again where you're calling from? What city you live in?
Calling from Denver. And we're really fortunate to have the Stars
Sounds like it.
Film Theater here. So we get every independent film that you can imagine. So, you know, we go a couple times a week at least.
Can I add one thing to that?
Please go, Peter Bart.
You know, I was looking at a confidential study of frequent filmgoers.
Uh-huh.
God love them, and you. But here is a factor. Mm-hmm. A tremendous majority of people who go to movies often increasingly resent the fact they have to sit through 20 minutes of commercials, the fact that concessions are ridiculously overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
What's building up among the frequent filmgoers is a real anger about the condition of the theaters and the way their movies are presented. I think that's something everyone has to think about.
Right.
Would you agree with that, Lisa?
You know, actually, that doesn't bother me that much. I mean, I don't mind previews. I always find them rather interesting. I mean, it's a really good point. And I think when you're a film addict, you go to the movies regardless. And I think that you just find that if you're at the Da Vinci Code or if you're at the Devil Wears Prada, it's a different type of audience, and there's definitely the 20-minute lead-up. But you just tend to gravitate back to these other types of films because, I don't know, I guess the noise, the craziness, the loudness, the formulaic sort of writing that seems to occur in the blockbusters gets old after a while.
And I think too, sometimes at in some cities that I've been to, and in New York, some of the smaller, the independent art houses, or even the ones that are part of the sort of art house chains, try to make the movie going experience a little more civilized as well. You know, so you can get sort of decent snacks from local bakeries and fresh made sandwiches and stuff like that, in addition to the popcorn and the soda.
That's certainly the case in Philadelphia as well. Yeah. But Peter, do you see there's going? Do you predict a revolution in exhibition that movie theaters will have to change to retain viewers?
I think that theaters that are catering to the more upscale audience are going to have to, as Tony says, serve food, allow drinks. And advance that advance ticket purchase and really cater to the audience more.
Peter, there are more and more theaters that have these sort of club aspects where you can order some food and drinks and have them brought to your seat. Did your survey say anything about those?
Yes, they are coveted and appreciated. Unfortunately, they're somewhat limited, and even those still give you that 20-minute dose of commercials.
And the difficulty is if you're, some of the theaters here in Denver do serve cocktails, and it is quite delightful. But if you've got young kids going to the movies, then you have to, you know, sort of decide, are you catering to the family audience or are you catering to the independent film audience? And so I think that makes it very difficult.
Well, they tend to put the M and R rated movies in those venues anyway. But Lisa, thank you very much. Interesting phone call.
Sure, District B-13 if you get a chance. I mean, it's just unbelievable French action.
Okay,
so, thank you so much,
Tony Scott. Have you seen District B-13?
I haven't, and I'm going to go and see it. That I have to say, that caller is really my ideal member of the film audience, and I'm very glad to hear from her.
And Carrie Rickey, she says she goes to 70 movies or so a year.
She didn't get paid for it.
Yeah, she didn't
even
get paid for it. You may do that in a month. So let's get another caller on the line. This is Pragati, I hope I'm getting that right, in Saratoga, Georgia. Excuse me, California.
No, Saratoga, this is Pragati, and I'm from Saratoga, California.
All right, we finally got that right. I apologize. Go ahead, please.
I was calling, actually, my 13-year-old son had a movie recommendation, Nacho Libre, and he saw it, and I'm not a huge Jack Black fan because I just find him a little immature for my taste.
No,
a little.
A little, yes. I prefer movies like Prada and all other that you mentioned in your show, so I'm going to give my phone to my son, Rishabh, who will tell you why he liked Nacho Libre.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey.
I wanted to talk about Nacho Libre.
And why did you like it?
I liked it a lot because I liked Napoleon Dynamite, and some of the stuff in Nacho Libre, the humor most of the time is some of the humor found in Napoleon Dynamite.
Same director, but,
and I find that most of the time people 15 and under or adults who are easily amused will like this film.
well said.
Also those who
I don't know any adults like that.
Also those who like their dialogue in an iambic pentameter, completely Shakespearean. Here's an example from Nacho Libre.
Listen to me. Today, I have the chance of a lifetime. But first, I need a man.
Get off me!
Don't you see? Your skills plus my skills in the ring. Tag team!
You're crazy. Aren't you tired of getting dirt kicked in your face? Don't you want a little taste of the glory? See what it tastes like.
No. If we win, we get 200 pesos.
And that seems to make the difference. You enjoyed the movie?
Yes, I did.
Okay. What did you guys think of Nacho Libre? A.O. Scott? Tony Scott?
Well, I guess I am easily amused after all. I thought it was a little thin for a feature. I actually found there's something about this director, Jared Hess, very young, still I think in his early or mid-20s, made Napoleon Dynamite when he was 23 or 24.
Mm-hmm.
He has a very distinctive kind of pacing and style, and the movie has these sort of slow, quiet deadpan sequences in addition to the ones like we just heard. And there's something very sweet and goofy and charming about it. It's not a movie that I expected to be charmed by, and I found that I was.
Hmm. Now, Carrie, Ricky, what did you think?
I liked Jack Black, and I enjoyed him, but most of the movie was fingernails on blackboard. I find that Hess is kind of like the Utah version of Wes Anderson. Too much tableau, not enough action for me.
Well, we know our critic there in Saratoga, California liked it.
But thank you. I really enjoy your enthusiasm. Thanks.
Keep going to the movies. Thanks very much for calling. We're talking today with Peter Bart, editor-in-chief of Variety, Carrie Ricky, film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and A.O. Tony Scott, a film critic for the New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go to Joyce. Joyce calling us from Somerville, South Carolina.
Hi.
Hi. Somerville, a lot of movies there.
Yes, quite a few. Yeah. Very few I will go to the theater to see, though.
Oh, how come?
Well, I'm a little disaffected by the whole experience a lot of the times. I don't like the ticket prices. I don't like how much the concessions cost. The previews, I don't mind. Previews are a little separate from the commercials, though.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got to be a really – there has to be something to the film to draw me into the theater.
And has any film succeeded thus far this summer?
Not yet. Devil Wears Prada will probably be the next film I see. The last film I saw in the theater was Inside Man.
Mm-hmm. And did you like it?
Yes, I did.
But it didn't bring you back to try another one?
Well...
No, not yet. Not yet.
Apparently not. Well, the things that come out in between. I usually don't go to the theater, you know, for repeat experiences.
No, no, no. I didn't suggest you go back and see it again. But
right.
Anyway, Peter Bart, this Joyce sounds like somebody from your survey.
Well, she does indeed. And, you know, trailers are fun, after all. I mm-hmm. enjoy them, too. It's just when they start the hard sell for products that you feel like, well, why did I leave my TV set? And the trouble is more and more people who are buying DVDs and have video games, there is such competition for that audience attention that I think it's very dangerous when the theater owners start monkeying with our attention span.
Hmm. Joyce, so you're going to go see The Devil Wore Prada?
Yes.
All right. Well, have a great time.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it.
Enjoy your show.
I wonder, Tony Scott, you guys often see films in screenings that are set up for reviewers in advance without a big audience. Does that make a difference when you're seeing a blockbuster?
A lot of the blockbusters you actually see in what they call all media screenings, which are in effect sneak previews.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, when I went to see the Pirates of the Caribbean last week. The press screening that they had, which all the New York press came to, was at the Ziegfeld, which is a huge old-fashioned
6,000 seats.
House. Yeah, 6,000 mm-hmm. seats. And it was filled with, you know, not just with media, but with people who had gotten tickets.
But people who presumably groan and laugh and cry at the right places.
Exactly. And that can be very helpful when you're trying to kind of gauge if let's say, a movie is a horror movie or a teenage comedy or a movie who the experience of which sort of depends on the audience's response, it can be very useful. And sometimes we do see them in screening rooms with a lot of other kind of with other critics. I mean, certainly the Da Vinci Code experience was a lot of us who were at the Cannes Film Festival and got right off the plane and went to the screening there and then I think, you know, expressed how we felt about mm-hmm. the whole experience in our reviews.
Carrie Ricky, does that kind of an experience color your reaction to the movie? It has to, somehow.
Well, I always have my own reaction. I love seeing movies with civilian audiences because they notice different things than I do. I actually saw Superman over the weekend, and there was a coming attraction for a Mark Wahlberg movie called Invincible about a Philadelphia Eagles player mm-hmm. who was drafted. The audience just erupted. Of course, it's Philadelphia, and it's the Philadelphia Eagles, but I just love the enthusiasm that I get in a civilian audience. Hmm. But with comedies, I kind of like seeing them just with critics so I can hear them.
So you can hear the dialogue
yes.
as opposed to the laughter that presumably
Correct.
Follows thereafter. All right.
It's a mix. I like seeing movies in an elite situation and in a mass situation. There's plus and minuses.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation on summer movies. We'll take a few more of your calls, plus an update on from Jerusalem as an ultimatum is issued on the fate of a soldier in Gaza. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're following at NPR News today. Israel has rejected an ultimatum by Palestinian militants who want Israel to release hundreds of prisoners before the militants release a captured Israeli soldier. Israel has continued a military offensive in Gaza to try to secure the release of the soldier. More on that in a few minutes. And NASA engineers will decide later today whether a pencil-sized crack in the foam insulation covering the Shuttle Discovery's fuel tank is serious enough to postpone the launch. The shuttle could be cleared for liftoff tomorrow if the weather cooperates. If repairs need to be made, Discovery has a launch window through the middle of this month. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll celebrate Independence Day with a look back at a critical year in the Revolutionary War with David McCullough, the author of 1776, plus the art of capturing fireworks on film without all the fuzz. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's continue our conversation about summer blockbusters. Our guests are Peter Bart, the editor-in-chief at Variety, Carrie Rickey, film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times. As Superman opened up this weekend, a surprisingly strong second showing from The Devil Wore Prada.
So you don't read Runway?
No.
And before today, you had never heard of me?
No.
And you have no style or sense of fashion?
Well, I think that depends on what you're...
No, no. That wasn't a question.
And the answer is The Devil Wears Prada, of course. Anyway, this film got awfully good reviews, Peter Bart, and it seems to be doing awfully well.
And it's a reminder that critics do matter. You know, the terrible thing about the summer blockbuster season is that critics should really simply take a long vacation, because these pictures are all critic-proof.
I'm hearing no objections from our critics.
For one thing, it's punishing to see.
I hope our editors are listening.
But another, apart from being punishing, I remember when I started in the movie business at studios, we opened a picture at four theaters and prayed for the critics to like us. That mm-hmm. was for the big pictures as well as the little pictures. I mean, today, when you open, you know, on 5,000 screens in the U.S. alone and pump $100 million into your campaign, it doesn't matter what anyone thinks. Prada is a delicious exception. Critics helped get some recognition for it. God love them.
Tony Scott, do you feel like you make a difference? Are you, in the words of Pirates of the Caribbean, spinning into the wind?
Well, I mean, it depends. I think that the reason that this was the case with The Devil Wears Prada is because the people going to see that movie in large numbers are probably people who read newspapers and who read film critics. That is, you know, older, perhaps grown-up people. Mm-hmm. Whereas the people who go to see the standard studio blockbuster maybe don't. But I think Peter's right. I mean, there's no way that we, as you know, lowly scribes, can compete with these hundreds of millions of dollars of marketing and publicity that precede the opening of the movie. I mean, Da Vinci Code is a great example of that. They had not showed any of that film to anybody until the very last minute, and yet they had managed to generate magazine covers and extraordinary awareness of this movie, sort of piggybacking on the best-selling book. So it wouldn't have mattered what if all of the critics in the world could have, and most did, say that it was a pretty bad movie, but people were going to go see it anyway.
I think where we make a difference, Neil, is with movies like Wordplay and Inconvenient Truth, The Devil Wears Prada, and so be it.
All right, let's get another caller in. Larry. Larry's calling us from Webster City in Iowa.
Yeah, Webster City.
Webster City, excuse me.
The reason I called is basically one of the things that I think your critics fail to mention is that if you're out in the sticks, which I am, nearest quote-unquote art house theater is about a half hour to an hour's away, drive away. Pretty much anything other than blockbusters I don't get to see until it comes out on video or on satellite. And the other thing that kind of ties into this is that for the most part, I don't go to see movies unless they're the blockbusters, simply because the blockbusters with all the really great special effects are the ones that really, where size makes a difference. You know, it's not so impressive to see Meryl Streep acting like a, you know, evil witch on large screen as it does on small screen.
I don't agree with you. I think that things that are larger than life are larger than life. And when you see Meryl Streep larger than life, the performance is bigger. But I do agree with you in to the extent that seeing X-Men or Superman on your TV isn't going to work, even if you have a 45-inch TV.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see it on the back of one of those airline seats. Yeah.
Well, those movies demand big screens. You can't watch them on your telephone.
All right, Larry, thanks very much for the call.
I'm sorry you don't have art films near you, though.
Yes, and what are you going to go see next?
Just saw Superman, liked it, probably the Pirates of the Caribbean.
All right, well, have a good time.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's see if we can get one last caller in on this. This is Trevor. Trevor's calling us from Cincinnati.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment, kind of what Larry just said. I really love the big blockbuster movies in general. I mean, but it also turns out to be the same ones that the critics like. And I just wanted to make a case for them, saying that, you know, I really think that, like, if Shakespeare were writing movies today, it would be car scenes and fight scenes and explosions and ghosts. And, yeah, I think that blockbusters can be large-scale and also subtle at the same time. And I've really enjoyed some. I mean, I'm thinking of Spider-Man 1 and 2, which
sure.
I really thoroughly enjoyed.
Peter, we agree with you on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Bart, you know, again, we had some people talking about your survey. They seem to go into that part of the returns as well. But what do you make of people like Trevor who like the big explosions?
Well, they own the world, don't they? Because those are the folks who are supporting the film industry. So I do think that the biggest long-term erosion is if the window separates between the time that a movie is opens theatrically and the time it's available in on DVD. If that window collapses, you're going to see a tremendous erosion of the basic economic structure of the movie business.
Hasn't that already happened, Peter?
No, not really. It's still holding just about the same. You know, that 3-4 month separation, despite all the rhetoric and despite.
Well, but a year ago it was 6 months, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, it's gone down a little bit, but it's holding. And Mark Cuban should stay to basketball, not.
Well, Bubble wasn't the best movie of the year.
But
Peter, do you think also that one of the things that's starting to happen is a kind of separating out what we heard from Larry, that the smaller the art films that aren't available where he lives anyway are what he'll see on DVD, and the big stuff that seems to demand to be seen on the big screen is what will keep theatrical exhibition going.
That's right, and that's why services like Netflix are doing really well. I mean, the biggest hits on Netflix are documentaries. I mean, even Capturing the Friedmans was a big hit.
But
I have a question, though. My kids don't make a distinction between movies they see on DVD and movies they see on the big screen, and I think this is increasingly true for people under 20.
I think their eyesight is better.
Well, they're also growing up with, you know, I don't know about your kids, but more and more people have, you know, plasma screen televisions. They have stereo speakers in their rooms. They have a home entertainment system that won't maybe give you quite the larger than life scale of the theatrical experience, but in some technical aspects can come pretty close.
Trevor, thanks very much for the call, and have a good time at the movies.
Okay, yeah, and I do enjoy and read your guys' work, and it does affect my decision.
All right.
Thank you.
With happiness all around, it's time to say goodbye. Thanks very much. Peter Bart, appreciate your time today.
You bet. Thanks.
Peter Bart, editor-in-chief of Variety, author of Boffo, How I Learned to Love the Blockbuster and Fear the Bomb. He was with us by phone from his home in Palm Springs, California. Carrie Rickey with us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, the film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Neil and Tony and Peter.
And Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, a film critic for the New York Times at our bureau in New York. Good to talk to you again.
Nice talking to all of you.